Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Happy St. Valentine's, everybody, directly from my heart to you.
Hello and welcome to Changes. I'm Annie McManus. You just heard the voice of the iconic punk poet, also known as the Bard of Salford, John Cooper Clarke. John started performing his witty poetry amidst the punk scene of the 1970s, sharing stages with musicians such as the Sex Pistols, the Buzzcocks and the Clash. His trademark look of big hair and drainpipe trousers, along with his instantly recognisable witty Mancunian delivery, have made him one of Britain's most famous poets. His most renowned poem, I Wanna Be Yours, has ended up on the UK curriculum, is often a favourite at weddings, and was famously used by the Arctic Monkeys on their song of the same name from the AM album. With that in mind, we thought we would get him on for an alternative Valentine's Week episode. It's a pleasure to welcome to Changes today, John Cooper Clarke.
Hello, Annie.
It's great to have you here. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
How are you with change in general?
Not good. I like every day to be exactly like the one that went before, if that was a good day. So, no, I'm a bit of a routine freak.
Yeah. Is that new? Is that always?
No, I think it's a quality I've always kind of had.
If I ask you the question, where do poems come from? What would you say?
That's a very intelligent question, and if I knew where poetry came from, I'd go there more often. No, I think the manufacture of poetry requires a kind of magic that can only come about through graft and a kind of monomania. A fixatory personality, I think, is a great help to any poet. That plus idleness. It begins as the plaything of an idle hour. And then if you're like me, it gets out of hand. I don't think it's entirely true that nobody likes poetry. I'm sure everybody gives it a go. The Feast of St. Valentine, for instance. Birthdays, christenings, engagements, all call forth, you know, the rhyming skills. Put it this way, Clinton cards ain't going out of business. Poetry itself couldn't be more accessible, is what I'm saying. Everybody gives it a go. But like I say, with me, it sort of got out of hand and turned into my actual job.
What is it about you, John Cooper Clarke, that made you that person that stuck to it and committed to it?
Well, I think I am a slightly kind of nerdy, flaky kind of person, you know. I was quite unhealthy as a kid. The sedentary life was really became my MO in a way.
Well, that was one of your answers for your childhood change. So when we asked you what your biggest childhood change was, you said recovering from TB.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
How old were you?
School age, you know. That was the great thing about it. It took me out of school, which I hated every minute of. Yeah. So it was great sort of... you know, I was more or less encouraged to be out in the fresh air. Yeah, so that meant, you know, I didn't have any friends in real. So I guess I kind of cultivated an inner life, as they say. But I've never written, having said that, I sound like, you know, that I write poetry for some cathartic purpose. But I wouldn't want you to run away with that idea, you know. Early on, when I found out I was good at it, you know, I wrote it with a view to reciting it in public for a living. So I've never seen it as a way of dealing with anything.
Yeah. It must do that, though, unconsciously. It must, even the act of writing, it must do something for you.
Yeah, well, it's, like I say, it's graft. I mean, what's inspiration? It's just an aimless electrical charge wouldn't stand up in a court of reality.
You also cited as a big childhood change, John, was the acquisition of a bicycle.
Yeah, that was a big thing. A very positive thing, obviously. It got me out of the house, bit of exercise, but, you know, relaxing at the same time. And in no time at all, I was on the main road. I was a bad kid.
Were you a bad kid?
Well, you know, no worse than anybody else. I was kind of cheeky, but I wasn't evil. Up to that point, at 11, 12 years old, I'd been a bookies runner. Everybody I knew, you know, used to have odd jobs for money, you know, at school, paper rounds, this, that and the other. But mine was a bookies runner. Thanks to my daddy, got me this job as a bookies runner when in the days when it was illegal. And they used to hire, like, kids who were too young to be seriously prosecuted to take the bets to the illegal bookkeeper. So I had this really lucrative job. If anybody's horse came up, it was the done thing that they should kind of, financial treat. I used to operate out of several barber shops and even three or four pubs. So I was kind of introduced to the sort of low-life world of degenerate gamblers, you know, at a very early age. But it never got out of hand because at an early age, I saw where it could lead, you know. But it was very lucrative. I was incredibly rich for a kid of my age, but I didn't know what to spend it on.
So did you spend it on the bike or was that already bought by then?
A lot of it, yeah, I bought the bike outright with it.
Yeah. Nice.
£4.50.
And John, can I ask you about Salford? Like, how did it shape you? How did it leave its mark on you?
It was a good place to live. You know, I mean, I didn't really live in Coronation Street kind of Salford. We always lived in apartments when I was a kid and on a main road above a chemist, you know. And you could walk into the centre of Manchester within 12 minutes from where I lived. So it was a kind of inner city existence. I loved it while I lived there. I really did. I was always a bit squeamish about the countryside. You know, when we went on holiday, I was glad to get back home. You know, but it was real kind of squalid back then, though. You know, bomb craters and heavy industry. You know, bad air. But we made our own entertainment.
So why did you want to leave?
I think I always wanted to get out because this is before the Beatles, really, you know, when it was unthinkable that you could ever make it in literature or music if you didn't move to London, frankly. So I just always had that on my horizon, you know, moving to London where the business is.
If we go on to the biggest change of your adult life, can you remember what you said for that?
The biggest change in my adult life would have been going professional, poetry-wise. After years of thankless endeavour upon the shop floor.
Which shop are we talking?
I was sort of part of a window cleaning round at one point. Apprentice motor mechanic. I worked in the rag trade as a cutter. And then I was a compositor. I was an apprentice printer.
Were you writing poetry at this time? Were you performing poetry at this time when you were working in the printers? And were you telling anyone about it?
No, I didn't tell anybody because, you know, it was... The piss taking would have got even worse than it already was.
Yeah.
No, but it's part of the... You know, one rips the piss out of each other in an industrial setting. But that would have been a step too far. That's what I thought. At the time, anyway, maybe I was wrong. Like I say, everybody gives it a go. Who knows? But it wasn't something that you'd kind of shout about until you were making a living out of it. And then it was, you know, manifest destiny. So I kind of took it into the nightclubs of Manchester just before punk. And I was working in these nightclubs that featured popular singers from years gone by who peaked, you know, a long time ago, but they had been big hitters, you know, household names.
Can we talk about you traveling the world? You say you circumnavigated the globe 10 times over. You're getting paid to do poems. It must have felt amazing. Then coming with that is fame. What are your memories, I suppose, of that time in terms of growing famous, becoming known?
Yeah, well, it was amazing, especially the first time I went to the United States.
Right.
That was sensational because I always envisaged doing that one, you know. I did my first gig in New York, for instance. It was very, very discouraging. That's another thing. By nature a very tenacious person, you know, and... But the two places where I'm glad I kind of persisted are Glasgow and New York.
Right.
Both of which, my first shows in both those towns were terrible.
Yeah.
But I didn't go home and say, you know, I wouldn't leave it alone. And I made them have it at a later date. And I'm so happy that I did that. But it could so easily have turned out differently. Because as I say, I'm not by nature a tenacious kind of person.
I mean, the absolute nerves it must take to walk out on a stage with no band initially, just you and a microphone, and be reciting poetry to people who've come to see music most of the time, or a lot of the time.
Yeah, that's right.
And to have to push through the conversations and be heard, that must have been terrifying.
Well, it's not given to everybody, but, you know, I guess there's a part of me that sort of, you know, there's a showbiz part of me that, you know, what did they say? They say if you're in, you know, if you're in show business, or to the extent that I am even, you know, you haven't got something extra, you got something missing. And that missing thing is, I don't know, a healthy degree of self-doubt, perhaps. So I've never really been a shrinking violet about it.
Yeah.
And it's the only, because I had to get over it, because it was the only way I could get any kind of public. You know, they weren't publishing poets to any great degree back then.
Yeah.
And anyway, the best way to appreciate poetry is to hear it rather than read it anyway.
Mm. And did you enjoy the fame?
Yeah, sure, yeah. But I don't think anybody really knows what it is. It quickly got to be a pain in the ass, but I don't think anybody has the imagination to be prepared for it. Mm. I mean, it's against nature, isn't it?
Yeah.
People are not supposed to have an opinion about you before you've even met them.
Yeah.
So it's a unique position that I don't think anybody's prepared for.
John, you spent a lot of the 1980s in drug addiction. You described it in an interview as a tedious and narrow life.
Well, it is, isn't it?
When you were on heroin. And why is that? Like, what is it about that life that
you're completely controlled by something, you know. It takes any kind of, I mean, I'm not the most spontaneous person in the world at the best of time, but it comes out of the question with that shit.
Right.
You know, what you're doing next Wednesday, I'll tell you on Tuesday night.
Right.
It's as good as it gets, isn't it? No, it's chaotic. I mean, that is the thing, isn't it? It's out of your control. It's chaotic. Some people mistake chaos for excitement. For it, you know, chaos is tedious.
Mm.
You know, an ordered life is really what you're after. I should never have opened that door.
Really? Is there a regret there?
Oh, absolutely. Of course.
Yeah.
It doesn't stalk my every waking. I don't walk the streets in torment.
Did you find that addiction changed you as a writer?
Yeah, stop writing. There was always something better to do than write a poem.
Yeah.
So, no, I didn't write anything for... 20 years, 15 years, 10, I don't know how long it was.
Did you ever go through doubt about your decision to be a poet? Like, did you ever doubt yourself in all of that time?
No, not really. Mm. I couldn't do any. It's the only thing I'm any good at. I never stopped writing. It just wasn't like suitable for public declamation, I suppose.
Oh, okay.
Just a different kind of stuff.
I mean, you had this amazing period of, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years I think it started in 2007 when your song Evidently Chicken Town came on the penultimate series of Sopranos, and then you had Plan B putting you on his album and his film, and then you had obviously the AM moment with Arctic Monkeys and I Want to Be Yours. What was it like to see your work kind of used in these ways?
Fantastic. As Elvis once said, ambition is a dream with a VA engine. That felt true at the time when all that was happening there. And especially the Arctic Monkeys doing utilising my lyrics on I Want to Be Yours, which has led to how many? What, over a billion hits worldwide on Spotify?
Yeah.
Blimey. I'm glad I wrote that one.
I bet you are.
Yeah, it's the wedding favourite of the 21st century as well.
This episode is going out on Valentine's week.
Oh, wicked. Oh, happy Valentine's Day, everybody.
How do you feel about Valentine's Day? Are you up for it?
Oh, absolutely. There's not enough romance in the world.
Are you a romantic guy?
To a sadistic degree.
Really?
Yeah, I love St. Valentine's Day, of course. Yeah, I write my wife, I shouldn't have said that. Mystery man, innit? Crikey, don't print that.
But so you don't ever print your name?
No. I think she knows my style by now. Yeah, dozen roses and the rhyme.
I wanted your views on romance and that kind of... like enforced romance that is thrust upon us by society sometimes when it's commercialised in that way and, you know, everyone's...
Well, that's the best kind.
You like that?
Yeah, I like that kind of thing. I like the commodification of romance. Yeah, it's part of pop music's strongest card.
Yeah. You mentioned your wife, Evie. I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, you met her in the late 80s. What was it about her that you fell for?
Well, her looks and is always the first thing, you know. Or,
and what did she look like?
Oh, terrific, yeah. And being French, you know, it kind of links up. She always reminded me of the late Jane Birkin.
Wow.
At that time.
What, beyond the looks?
Oh, she's the sweetest personality. After my parents, the sweetest woman, you know, after my mum, the sweetest woman I ever met.
And then you had a daughter with Evie Stella. What surprised you about becoming a parent, if anything?
It was a surprise. I was very, very late in the day for me. Fantastic, though. All my friends had them real young and they were all like, oh, don't have children. You know, kind of disgruntled dads by the time they were 36. So I thought it must be nobody's got a good word for it. Yeah. So if I'd have known how much fun it is, I would have had another 17. But they wouldn't have all been like Stella. Yeah. You know, no, a sweet kid. It's great. Fantastic.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
John, what would be the change that you'd still like to make or see in the world?
Ah, the return of mass literacy, liberty, romance, and the habit of gentleness.
I mean, that is a beautiful, beautiful utopia right there.
It's very backward. It's very kind of, yes, it's quite, in essence, quite romantic. It's
natural
in a person of my years. There's a great deal of melancholy and loss in those choices.
Yeah. The habit of gentleness, especially. Why that?
I think it was the first casualty. I could blame it on computers, but what do I know? What do I know about it? I don't know. It was the first casualty of something.
Yeah.
The habit of gentleness.
And mass literacy.
I don't know whether I believe the scare stories or not, you know, thank God Almighty. I don't have to think about schools and education anymore. Yeah. I can't believe my daughter, she up to a point, she really liked going to school.
Yeah.
I was never like that at any point.
Yeah, you didn't like it. It didn't suit you.
No, I hated it. Yeah, I really did. But you know, having said that, you know, I'm glad they rendered me, literate. So a great deal to thank the education system. But I was certainly quite the ingrate at the time.
Getting back to romance and the fact that this is coming out on Valentine's week, can I ask you some questions in a kind of agony uncle way where I ask you some situations that I would like to get your take on?
Sure, why not?
So let's say someone's listening who is in a relationship and they want to make it a long-lasting relationship. What would you say is the secret to kind of that longevity in a romantic relationship?
Maintaining, I ought to know because I've done
exactly
that.
Well, you're
exactly
in a lovely long one. Yeah.
I've done exactly that, but again, I think it involves some kind of magic that I don't want to interfere with. Do as you're told. that's good advice for the guys out there. Just do as you're told.
Okay, love that. What about if someone is listening who fancies someone but's too scared to make a move?
Employ the services of a go-between.
Right.
Who would talk up your best qualities to this woman.
Yeah.
and await the outcome.
Yeah. It's a bit like, that's a bit playgroundy, that one, isn't it? It's like, my mate fancies you.
Alternatively, play 'em like a fish.
Okay.
One of the two.
That's two great options. If someone is listening right now and they're heartbroken, they've just had their heart broken, they've been dumped from a great height, what would you say to them?
Next time, it won't be this bad. You'll never have your heart broken like that again.
It's true. The first time is the worst time.
First time's the worst time, isn't it? Nobody will ever break your heart like that again.
No. Have you ever had your heart broken like that?
Oh, yeah.
Can you remember it?
Yeah. We drifted apart in the harsh winter of Salford, yeah.
Right,
it's in the book. Sheila. Yeah.
Sheila. I left home for her. You left her home for her?
Yeah. We got a place on Camp Street. Because it was a low-rent sort of ghetto full of, you know, art students and hookers and what have you.
Yeah.
Malcontents of one kind or another.
Mm.
So, but it was freezing. So we kind of started going home to our respective parents at tea time.
Just to stand finally, next to the super serve for a bit.
Until finally none of us could countenance going back to this freezing apartment on Camp Street. So we kind of, for the good of our respective health, we split up. Quite undramatically, but it was heartbreaking nevertheless.
I bet.
It never happens it mutually, you know. And she went off the boil before I did.
Yeah.
So.
Do you think it's important to have your heart broken?
At an early age. Get it out of the way. But after that, I'm not saying you never, it's never going to happen again. But it ain't going to,
It's never going to be happen so intensely, right? Like the pain.
It's not heartbreak. It's a hairline fracture from then on in.
Yeah. Yeah. Would you consider reading out I Want to Be Yours.
No problem.
Your most romantic poem for our lovely listeners.
It would be churlish to refuse.
Go for it.
Okay, this is the wedding favourite of the 21st century. I Want to Be Yours, also the title of my memoir, on sale at All Good Stockists. I Want to Be Yours by Dr. John Cooper Clarke. Let me be your vacuum cleaner, breathing in your dust. Let me be your Morris Marina, I will never rust. If you like your coffee hot, let me be your coffee pot. You call the shots. I want to be yours. Let me be your raincoat for those frequent rainy days. Let me be that dream boat when you want to sail away. Let me be your teddy bear. Take me with you anywhere. I don't care. I want to be yours. Let me be your electric meter. I will never run out. Let me be the electric heater you get pneumonia without. Let me be that setting lotion that grips your skull with deep devotion. Deep as the deep Atlantic Ocean, that's how deep is my devotion. A deep, 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 deep. I don't want to be hers, I want to be yours. Happy St. Valentine's, everybody. Directly from my heart to you.
Woo! Yeah! Incredible. Thank you so much, John.
Pleasure.
Now, John, your book, What, is out now. It looks absolutely beautiful, and you're going to be going on tour as well from the 5th of March, you know, reciting this poetry and more, obviously. There are tickets available, by the way, so if anyone is listening who wants to go and see John in action, do that. Please do that. Have you noticed a change in your audience?
Oh, no, every kind of people. Every kind of people is my audience. I'm so happy to say that, you know, really, yeah. You know, all ages, all kinds of people. Unbelievable, yeah. You know, yeah. What a bit of TV will get you. Amazing. I mean, a cab driver, I was stood outside the hotel in South Kensington a few weeks ago, and a guy, he was carrying a fare. He screeched to a halt, jumped out and said, John Cooper Clarke, my favourite poet, shook me by the hand, got back in the car.
Wow.
Got back in the car. People would have been surprised. I mean, not long ago, people would have been quite surprised that a London cabbie would have a favourite poet at all. So you can't buy that kind of validation. And I'm very happy to say this, you know, every kind of people.
Love that. Thank you so much, John, for taking the time today to speak to us. And it was such a pleasure to have that time with you. Thank you.
Pleasure was mine, Annie. Thank you very much.
If you enjoy Changes, please do rate, review and subscribe to the podcast. Share it with your friends and family. Go on social media. Tell everyone about it. Tag me, Annie McManus. I always love to see how you react to these episodes. And it's just so helpful to be seen and to be shared by you lot. So thank you so much if you do. There's a whole catalogue of episodes to listen to. If you have missed any at all, go back and check them out. And we'll be back next week. Changes is produced by Louise Mason with assistant production from Anna DeWolf Evans. See you next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.